Do I have it now? Today I want to talk about the Berkovich projective line as an object in analysis. One of the major reasons for wanting to pass from the classical P1 of CP to something bigger is that it's very difficult to find natural ways of doing analysis on a totally disconnected space where the topology has to be given in some kind of artificial way by a structure which essentially lives outside of the space. Whereas if you have a compact Hausdorff space which is path connected, you have a much better shot at being able to do analysis in a natural way. And that is the case, in fact, is the main reason that I think Berkovich originally introduced the whole idea of these spaces. He wanted to do functional analysis on the spaces and found that he could do so there. So I want to focus today on the projective line, the Berkovich projective line, in the following way. In particular, I want to talk about the Laplacian, which lives on it, and applications of Laplacian to dynamics. So we will see that many familiar functions from arithmetic geometry, if you're an arithmetic geometer, have natural extensions to the Berkovich projective line, and if you take their Laplacians, then they are also arithmetically interesting objects. In order to do this, we want to view the Berkovich projective line in a slightly different way than I discussed yesterday. This will be a natural way to think about it, given what was done last time, but I want to view the Berkovich projective line as an inverse limit of finite graphs. So if we think about P1 Berk as I did loosely last time, where you have P1 of CP on the outside and you have some kind of a complicated tree structure, again, fiercely branched at countably many points, countably many branches, everything is branching at countably many points, then it's hard to get a hold of what's going on. But if we look at some finite subgraph contained in it, then we can think about that finite subgraph in a natural way. And you can see that if we were to want to enlarge this finite subgraph by adjoining more edges onto it, that could be done, and you can continue to expand out and in this way get an inverse system of graphs which basically exhaust the interior portion of the Berkovich projective line. So a directed system, you have inclusions, and we're going to want to include smaller ones and larger ones. That's perhaps true, but the maps go from the bigger ones to the smaller ones. The maps we're interested in are retractions from a bigger map to a smaller one. So the type 4 points are sort of in the interior, but what you don't see, and what actually this is a significant point, is that the values at the classical points don't make any difference in terms of analysis. It's only what happens on the interior points that matters for defining Laplacian and for defining values of the function. You can completely redefine them or leave them undefined, whatever you want to do, as long as you have a function defined on the interior, then it's defined on all the graphs. So it makes only a difference what happens on the interior. So if you have gamma 1 is contained in gamma 2, we have a retraction map. R gamma 2 gamma 1, which simply takes each piece into the point where it lands on that resulting graph, and that is the map that we are interested in looking at. You can see that this system of maps commutes, and so we're going to be considering what happens as we take an inverse limit over all finite graphs relative to these retraction maps. Okay, so I'm interested in looking at finite graphs. I want to talk to you for a moment about each of these finite graphs. So consider one of these graphs. So this guy is generally called the Berkovich half space, the Berkovich plane. It's not exactly like many people get confused about trying to think about the p-adic upper half plane of Mumford and Manin. It's not that thing. It's just the interior points that we look at like that. Now, there is a natural metric on the interior points. We have a metric rho of xy between two points. So if x corresponds to a disk d of a little r and y corresponds to a disk of larger radius, then this was equal to the logarithm of the ratios of the radii. That's the definition for points that lie between each other. You can make a generalized definition by making the geodesic length relative to this distance. Now, the key thing which makes this useful is that this is completely canonical. It's independent of the choice of coordinates. Or another way to say this is if you have an LFT which acts upon the Berkovich space, then the image of two points have the same distance apart as the original points did. So if phi from phi in Cp of t is an LFT, a linear fractional transformation, then you have rho of phi of x, phi of y is equal to rho of xy. So for such things, it doesn't make a difference how you change coordinates. That means that each of these graphs is not only a topological finite graph, but it is also a metric graph, a graph with a natural distance along its edges. So if we have a finite graph of this type, you know, I've made a mistake already. I have apparently written on the backboard, but I'll just ignore that for this time and pass on to the next one. So each edge has a natural length on it, and we will commonly view the edges of graphs as being parametrized by real segments using the arc length parameterization, namely the distance here. So every edge can be obviously parameterized by a segment in such a way that the distance between two points is just the difference between the parameters. So with these preliminaries, I am in a position to talk about the Laplacian on a graph. The idea is that in order to define the Laplacian on the Berkovich projective line, I want to first define the Laplacian on a graph, which is a much easier thing to do, and then for a certain class of functions, of course, you know, even in classical analysis, you can't differentiate anything. You have to have C2 or C1 functions or something, so you have to define a class of functions that you're going to hope to differentiate. In this case, we'll have an appropriate class of functions for which we can define a measure-valued Laplacian, and I'll describe that class of functions in a moment. But first we want to define the Laplacian on a graph. So the idea is, as I have said, we want to parameterize each of the edges of gamma using the arc length parameterization. And then we want to consider functions on the graph which are piecewise C2 and have finite boundary derivatives at each edge of the pieces. So, you know, we may want to subdivide the graph into a finite number of pieces. We'll certainly want to have the vertex set in the subdivision points, but the idea is that we want to consider continuous functions which are piecewise C2 and have finite boundary limits under this finite subdivision. So let's let ZH of gamma, this is the so-called Zhang space because Shou Zhang in a paper defined a Laplacian on this class of functions, be the set of all continuous piecewise C2 functions F from gamma to the reals with finite boundary limits. For a function f in the Zhang space, we're going to define Laplacian in the following way. It's going to have a contribution which comes from the edges, the continuous part on the edges, and it's also going to have a contribution which comes from where you have sharp corners where the different pieces come together, or where different branches come together, or where endpoints occur. Now, the Laplacian has a sign choice that you can make based on various other factors. Ours is the negative of one that is used by Rivera, Tesselier, and Faber, and also the negative of the one used by Thier in order to make the Laplacian positive semi-definite, in a sense that we'll see in a moment. But what we define is to be the negative of the sum over the edges of f double prime of x dx, and this again is the arc length parameterization. So as long as you're in the middle of a segment, f double prime makes perfectly good sense, and it's also invariant under which direction you traverse the segment. The sign, second derivative will cancel out the sign, minus the sum over points, and we want to take the sum over the tangent directions of the directional derivatives of f at the point P. So you can see that at each point P, you have a finite number of formal unit vectors. I'll call these, you can think of a parameterization with a formal unit vector in each direction. And this is just a symbol for the directional derivative as you go away from the point P relative to the arc length parameterization of the one-sided derivative at each of those points, which is why I wanted to have these finite boundary derivatives in the definition of this class of functions. So these are derivatives on edges leading away from P. So perhaps it would be good to give an example of how this works out for a kind of a simple graph. So let's suppose that gamma is a graph with three edges of length 1, and I'll call these things P and Q1, Q2, and Q3, three edges of unit length. And for my function, I want to consider the function, I'm going to redraw it here in some kind of perspective here. I want to consider the function which is constant on the first edge and which is quadratically decaying on the second edge and which is linearly decaying on the third edge. So I'm going to take my function defined in the following way. Let me parameterize these things, the segment PQI, by a variable TI in 0 to 1. So each of these points, this will be T1, it's increasing in that direction, T2 is increasing in that direction, sorry, this is T3, and this is T2 increasing away from P in the middle. So I'm going to have f of x is equal to 1 if x is an element of PQ1, and I'll have it be equal to 1 minus T2 squared if x is corresponding to the point T2, and I, by abusive notation, just write x equals T2 in PQ2, and I'll have it be 1 minus T2 if x is equal to, sorry about that, this is T3, is in PQ3. So what can we say about the derivatives on each of the segments here? So we can see on segment PQ1, we can see that f double prime of x is equal to 0. Constant function has second derivative 0. And if we have the directional derivatives here, let me call these directional derivatives here, what's a good name for these things? Okay, I'm going to call these things v1 and w1, and here's, that was v2 and w2 and v3 and w3. So we see here that dv1 of f, of course, is equal to 0. And dw1 of f at, what have I called these things? Q's, I'm sorry. That's equal to 0 as well. Okay, so on PQ2, we have that f double prime of x is equal to minus 2t2. We can see that f, that dv2 of f at q, I'm sorry, I've probably gotten these things a little bit confused on the first one. So P is this, and this is Q1. Yep. And this is P. So this one was horizontal at 0, and dW2 of F, okay, at Q2. Okay, so we're trying to take the derivative that goes inward towards this thing. This function is increasing at a rate 2, and we see that that's equal to 2. it's backwards from the slope that you might be expecting. And on PQ3, we can see that f double prime of x is equal to 0 dv1 of f at p, no, this is v3, is, let's see, this would be equal to, looking at a linear slope going down straight, so it's minus 1, and dw3 of f at q3, this is now looking backwards at this thing, so that would have slope equal to 1. It's 2, thank you. I forgot the thing there. It's minus 2. And so we can see that the Laplacian of gamma of f is going to be having as its continuous part minus 2 times the t1, maybe I'll put as t1. Ooh, I'm just crazy. There's no contribution at all from this first edge, is there? Okay, so it's minus 2 dt2. And then we have the contribution at the origin. There is nothing there. So there's minus 0 times the Dirac at P, minus 2 times the Dirac at Q2. And then there's also a contribution that comes from this third edge. And that contribution will be minus the Dirac at P, and then plus the Dirac at Q3. So that the whole sum of everything turns out to be minus 2 dt2 plus delta p minus 2 delta q2 minus delta q3. I'm wanting to have, this is a minus this here.
No, there's
so there's a plus somewhere? That's good. Yes, it's a minus here, so that's a plus. All right, I don't know about all these things, but what one thing I was hoping to demonstrate is that the thing has total mass 0. All right, so this Laplacian has total mass 0, and that's a characteristic function, characteristic property of every type thing. It's an identity that you can see easily holds that holds in every case here. All right. So the Laplacian turns out to be, if you work it out correctly and more properly, in general a sum of multiples of the dx on the edge and then some Dirac functions at boundary points between pieces.
So shouldn't the expression up there involve a Dirac somewhere?
Thanks. I'm talking about integrating over the whole base gamma. The total mass over the whole graph gamma is always going to be 0. There's a larger space on which you can make sense of a measure value Laplacian. It's called by us BDV of gamma. stands for bounded differential variation. Just as you can consider functions a bounded total variation in considering derivatives, you want to sort of find functions whose first derivative has total variation. And for them, we are able to define a Laplacian, which extends this Laplacian up here. It's just a more abstract, inclusive class. So we will define the class of functions on P1 Burke to be the class of functions which, when restricted to every graph, belong to the class we can differentiate there, and which also have the property that their measure-valued Laplacians have uniformly bounded total mass, independent of the graph gamma, but with a bound depending on the function. So it may not be obvious that there are interesting functions which have those properties, but I charge myself with combating that illusion in the later parts of the lecture. So the class of functions on P1 Burke that we want to consider we're going to have functions which are finite, actually, on the interior part, and it really doesn't matter whether they're defined on P1 of C or not, but for purposes of this talk, we'll just allow it to be plus or minus infinity, with the property that the restriction of F to each gamma belongs to BDV of gamma for each subgraph, finite subgraph gamma, and also that the total variation of the Laplacian total mass of Laplacian is bounded by a constant depending only on F, but not on gamma. So for such functions, we can show that if you have gamma 1 is a subgraph of gamma 2, then the push forward of the Laplacian of F is equal to the Laplacian of F restricted to gamma 1. So what this means is that if you are looking at a larger subgraph outside, then any mass that was supported on the parts outside becomes point masses on the points where the graphs attach. So if there's any mass that didn't cancel out, it'll become a point mass at the places where it attaches, which typically means that the function had a corner there. And then this allows us to find delta of F to be the inverse limit of the resulting Laplacians under these restriction maps. There is perhaps something to be said about how to take this inverse limit. It means that you have to let these things act on an appropriate class of functions, namely BDV of gamma, and by duality, they induce a functional on that space, and then the Riesz representation theorem allows you to define the measure as an inverse limit. So this uses the Riesz representation theorem, but the inverse limit of the measures is the one that comes up naturally. So this is the Laplacian on Berkovich space. I want to now give some examples of functions that are arithmetically interesting in this way. So if you have a non-constant rational function, if, let's say, f of x is equal to the log of the absolute value of a rational function, I suppose it's okay if it's not zero. So, so what do I want to talk about here? So classically, if you thought about classical points, you could simply take the p-adic absolute value at the classical points. How do you Berkovichevize this? You simply want to replace this f by the supernorm at the point or the corresponding x. And so this gives us a function on the corresponding thing. Okay? So, time being somewhat short, I'll just mention that it turns out that the Laplacian is basically the Dirac of the, I should have a minus sign in here, of the divisor of f. And we can easily see this if we were to look at the special case that f of x is f of t is equal to t minus a point A, and we had the line of disks d of AR going from 0 to infinity, then you can see that the supernorm of f of t on a disk d of AR, why, that is going to be exactly equal to R. So we can see that minus log of f of t, f of f, is equal to minus log r, which is the arc length parameterization of the edge. This is the arc length parameterization. And so this is basically a minus a constant along the edge. On the other hand, if you had some edge that came off of the segment from 0 to infinity, then you would find out that the function, this was constant on all branches that come off. So it basically is only changing along the line from A to infinity, and it's constant on edges off, and so the Laplacian is going to turn out to be just a limit of Dirac's that are 1 and minus 1 as you go farther and farther out towards infinity, which turns out to be this thing here. So you can take a product of these things. So if you have the negative log of f there, then you wind up getting the divisor of f reproduced back again. More generally, you can consider the proximity of a function to a fixed point on the interior of Berkovich space. So if you have B is a point in P1 Berk, but not in P1 of CP, then you can take the Laplacian of the proximity of f of x to the number b, and this will turn out to be equal to, well, you will have the part that corresponds to infinity coming off, because we haven't taken off that part, but we'll have the sum of the points with phi of a equal to b of the multiplicities. We're just going to use this for phi right now, of a as rac of b minus the polar part. So in this way you can recover the multiplicities in an analytic construction from having Laplacian. Next, I want to look at heights. So heights have featured prominently in all of the talks so far, and they play a role here as well. So if phi is of degree greater than or equal to 2, so let's try again. If phi in K of t, where this is, in our case, a number field, has degree greater than or equal to 2, we can define the canonical height h hat phi of alpha to be the limit as n goes to infinity of 1 over the degree of the function times the naive height of the iterates of a given point alpha, there being some discussion that needs to be made of where alpha lies. This is for alpha in the ground field moment. Now, the thing that hasn't been mentioned so far is that there's a natural decomposition of the global height into local heights. So, given a homogenization. Of the function phi of t. And so what do we want to do here? So we want to take phi of t, and we want to write t as being y over x. And so then we can write this thing as x to the n times some f of y over x, and x to the n g of y over x. And this will give us a capital F of xy over g of xy. So two homogeneous polynomials of degree d. Then we can define in a natural way the Carl Silverman local heights. I'll write them h phi v hat of alpha. And the important point is that if you take the sum over all places of the number field, then the sum of the local heights equals the global height. Again, there has to be some discussion about where alpha lies to make this completely correct, but we can certainly define the local heights. And the local heights are the objects that we're mostly going to be interested in from the rest of the talk on. So the global canonical height has the property, as has been mentioned as many times before, that if you compose it with phi, then you multiply the global height by alpha. And there's a slightly more complicated functional equation that works for the local factors as well, but I'm going to mostly ignore that right now because it doesn't matter for the end result. So here, how do we find these things? If we put capital phi of x and y be the pair of functions f of xy and g of xy, and we iterate by composition here, we get two new functions, fn of xy and gn of xy. That is, you iterate n times, and you will define these functions in this way. Then the local height is defined to be the limit as n goes to infinity of 1 over d to the n of the log of the maximum of the absolute value of fn of 1x and the corresponding thing for g. So maybe I should put in an alpha in here to make it look better. So this is a limit, and you can see it depends on the harmonization. If you chose something different, it would give you a differing thing by a constant, which by global analysis falls out in the end. So there's a way to normalize these things that I don't want to go into. It doesn't matter as far as we're concerned. But this is the definition of the corresponding thing. Now, this is for a classical point. How do we Berkoviciize? Okay, class, how do you Berkoviciize something? So you want to send h hat cv of a point x to be the limit as n goes to infinity of 1 over d to the n log of max, and in place of the absolute value, you simply want to take the Berkovich corresponding value at the so the moral of the story is that basically, most interesting functions you construct arithmetically extend in a natural way by continuity to the Berkovich space. This is, in fact, the only way to extend this thing by continuity to the interior of Berkovich space. Now, it requires proof, but this thing does belong to the space BDV of P1. So that makes it interesting to take the Laplacian. So we can see the Laplacian of h phi v of x. Well, it turns out to be the Dirac measure at infinity minus a measure mu phi v. Now, just as in the case where we're giving a finite graph, the total mass of the thing is always zero, this turns out to be a probability measure. Measure of total mass 1 supported on Berkovich space. And the functoriality properties of h phi v hat show that it has the properties that if you pull back this measure mu phi v by the measure phi, you get d times itself. That's the local analog of this functional equation. And by the formal relationships between pullbacks and push-forwards, we can see that the push-forward of this measure is itself. So these are exactly the properties that the classical Brolin, Lubitsch, Freire, Manier, Lopez measure had. So we have constructed an analog of the classical invariant measure in the Archimedean case. In the classical case, this invariant measure has as its support precisely the classical Julia set. So we define the Berkovich-Julia set to be the support of this measure. Clearly, by the properties of the measure, it's both forwards and backwards invariant. And the Berkovich-Fatou set, FV, will be the complement of the Julia set. This being the support of the measure is obviously closed, compact. And since this is a probability measure, it is not empty. And if you remember from Rob's talks, it could very well happen that the semi-classical Julia set in P1 of CP was empty. But this one, by its very definition, cannot be empty. And clearly this thing is open. They're both bi-invariant. Likewise, we define the Fatou components are the connected components. Of the Fatou set, the topological connected components. And it still remains to be said why these have any dynamical system, but certainly they dynamical significance, but they certainly are making sense as topological connected components, which is a very natural definition. So I suppose there are different starting points. I believe that one begins by defining the Berkovich-Julia and Fatou sets in terms of properties of repelling fixed points and periodic points and so forth, but one can start in this direction and work the other direction. The key theorem is an equidistribution theorem. So recall that the exceptional set I'm working in CV at the moment, I guess, is the set of points X in P1 of CP, CV. Let me write P because I'm just wanting to talk about CP right now. And with finite grand orbits, with finitely pre-images. And it's well known that there are at most two such points, this being a consequence of the fact that the field is of characteristic zero, and the Riemann-Hurwitz formula tells you that you have a certain bound on the number of ramified pre-images or something. So the theorem says that if you have any point which is not in the exceptional locus, the classical exceptional locus, then the sequence of measures mu y n to be equal to the sum over the points with phi n of x equal to y, the multiplicity of x times the Dirac of x. Oh yes, and I need to divide this thing by the degree of the composite function in order to make it a probability measure. Note that the multiplicities enter in, so we're wanting to weight the points with the multiplicity that they occur. Converges weakly. To the canonical measure. So this was a theorem originally proved by Faber and Rivera-Letelier. Matt and I have a related but somewhat different proof as well. So once one has the equidistribution theorem, nearly all the classical consequences, the classical basic facts about Fatou and Julia theory fall out. So among these facts are the omitting 3 points property. So if we have x is in the Julia set, then every neighborhood we have the union from n equals 1 to infinity of the forward images of U is going to contain everything except for possibly the exceptional points. While if X is in the Fatou set, then for some neighborhood, the union from n equals 1 to infinity of phi n of u omits at least 3 points of P1 of CP. So this omitting 3 points property that characterizes the Fatou and Julia sets holds as well. I should comment that there's been quite a lot of thought given to how one should properly define Fatou components by some people in this room. And initially, one might try to do definitions using normality, which simply do not work. And then one can take definitions using equicontinuity, and that works for P1 of CP, but not very well for the Berkovich space, although one can make it work, and using deep theorems of Rivera, make it work in general, but it kind of doesn't work. But if you use the definition of the omitting 3 points definition of these things, the consequence that's often used, that works well as a definition. Of course, infinitely many, actually, but so this was Rivera's definition of the Fatou definition. Using this, one can show that all repelling periodic points belong to the Julia set. for this purpose, you have to include both in P1 of CP and in the Berkovich space. So we're talking about all of the ones, including the ones I talked about yesterday with the multiplicity bigger than one, and they are dense in J phi. So this argument is, I guess, proved by many possible ways, but you can carry through the classical argument about Julia using homoconic orbits in this setting. So one can show that J phi is either connected, well, it's perfect. So it's either a single point or is uncountable. And you can show that either J phi is either connected or has uncountable any components. Thus far, our list of examples of known Julia sets is somewhat limited, but I should mention that you have the good reduction case, in which case the Julia set is just the point, single point, and it is possible to have a segment or to have a Cantor set supported in the classical points, or to have a Cantor set supported in the interior as well, and I just don't know what other kinds of things can come up, whether you can get branch segments or otherwise, but these possibilities at least arise. So I think the moral of the story is that in the setting of P1 Burke, basically all the elementary theorems of classical dynamics about Fatou and Julia theory carry through without change. And that makes one feel that you've got the right definition of objects. Okay? Thank you.
Well, when you started to define what components the Fatou set were, but then it looked pretty like you were just defining what the Julia and Fatou set were at the time. I mean, the three points thing characterizes the Julia set, right? And the Fatou set.
Right. So if you have a point, you can take the question of whether there's a neighborhood whose forward images omit three points, or whether that doesn't happen. If there's some neighborhood that omits at least three points, then it belongs to the Fatou set. And if every neighborhood has a property that its forward images omit at most two points, then it will be in the Julia set. Now, one can, as it were, partition the Fatou set into components, which are the connected components of this thing. And it turns out that if you have U as a component of the Fatou set, then this property is also true for that component. That is, if you take a component and you take the forward images of a Fatou component, it omits three points as well. And it's the largest connected open set that has that property, because sort of by definition, its boundary belongs to the Julia set. And if you were to include a point of the Julia set, then you'd get omitting at least at most two.
So you define components by connectivity to the connected space.
Yes. So component means topological connected component in the usual sense.
Okay.
But this fact I'm mentioning shows that if you take the intersection of such a component with the classical points, then that corresponds, if you know Rivera-Letelier's definition, to one of Rivera's definitions of the Fatou component. So Rivera had a somewhat esoteric definition, but it turns out just to coincide with this. Not known to me. One hopes that there is a whole collection of differential operators analogous to DDC and wedge products, but that is not known either. So basically, one hopes that there's some R-Califf theory, right, living there, and this is the one-dimensional case of some part of R-Califf theory.
Can you get the degree of something to be the integral of?
I can't. Now, maybe you can.